If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Schoenbrunn. I'm your host. My guest today is Rachel Mickelberg, who grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and still enjoys living there with her husband, Richard, and their two dogs, Nala and Beanie. She earned her Bachelor of Music degree in vocal performance from San Jose State University and has performed leading roles in the musicals and opera from Carmen to My Fair Lady, as well as the part of Mother Abbess three times in The Sound of Music. When Rachel isn't working with one of her 20 voice and piano students, she loves gardening, hiking, and baking sourdough bread. Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver, is her first book. Please help me welcome Rachel Mickelberg. Rachel, how are you?
I'm well, Ari. Thank you. So great to be here.
Oh, yes. I'm very happy to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, as you know, the name of the podcast is Whispers and Bricks. The whispers are those voices telling us what the right thing to do is, and they represent the good in life. And the bricks represent the bad things that we go through in life. And we all know that, you know, life is not a straight line, many ups and downs, many bumps in the roads. You know, people get hit with more bricks, less bricks, bigger bricks, smaller bricks, but everybody gets hit at some point in time or another. Now, your life seemed to have started out pretty good, but then took a turn for the worse. Now, I think the first brick happens when your marriage starts to decline. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd had several other stumbles along the way, which I do talk about in the book, but those felt small-ish in comparison to what happened about 10 years, almost 10 years into my marriage. My husband's name was David. We had two children, ages 6 and 7 years old. And our marriage was in trouble at the time that of this tragedy, this trauma that I'm about to explain. And so that's an important setup for why I made the decisions that I made after this trauma, which was that he was flying in a small airplane with one other. He was the passenger. There was a pilot, and the plane crashed, and it crashed into a vineyard on the central coast of California. Both men survived miraculously. It's not every day you hear that people survive a plane crash, but they did. But they, because they weren't wearing shoulder harnesses, it was an older plane and there was a grandfather clause. The plane wasn't equipped with them. Both men hit their heads pretty hard on the instrument panel of the airplane. My husband, David, was knocked unconscious. And the other guy remained conscious and pulled David from the wreckage. David sustained a very severe traumatic brain injury, essentially from the, his skull was split open from the middle of his nose up to the crown of his head. So the entire frontal lobe of the brain was, smashed, if you can picture
that.
Wow. Yeah. And in fact, normally with a head injury, they actually have to open up the skull a little bit because of the swelling in the brain and they need to give it room. In his case, they didn't need to do that because the skull was already split open. I'm sorry about those gory details, but it's truth. So it threw, of course, all of us into, in an instant, as with you, with that plane hitting the tower, it altered the course of so many people's lives. And in this case, I was really struggling with the reality that which I learned eventually would be the case, that David would not recover. He would improve, but he would not recover. He would never recover his ability to be a father, to be, for certainly to be a provider, to maintain any kind of relationship as we know it. Mm-hmm. In addition to all the physical issues, which for the most part healed, there were spinal injuries, severe spinal injuries, pancreatic injuries. He lost an eye. Well, he didn't lose the eye, but he became blind in one eye because of the pressure on the optic nerve. So it was just devastating. And in my book, I really wanted to explore the incredible ambivalence I felt about having this role of being his caregiver, inheriting it sounds like a very passive way. It just became my role. And at first, you know, it was mostly about managing all the doctor. He was in the hospital for a very long time, the ICU. And then, he was just physically in such terrible shape. He'd had several facial reconstruction surgeries. And, there was just so, as you can imagine, so many different elements that we had to deal with.
How did this affect your family and your kids for the most part?
Right. Well, so at first, you know, it was a question of how to tell them the truth. Because at first I didn't. At the very beginning, I just told them that, you know, Daddy was hurt. We didn't know, right? And then when I learned it, I actually had my rabbi. I was a cantor at the time, and I actually asked my rabbi to come and talk to them because I was afraid about their reaction when they learned that their dad would never really be the same. And how do you explain that to a 6-year-old, you know, and a 7-year-old? But then it was a question of making arrangements to get them to the hospital to visit him and to just kind of make that part of our daily lives. And it wasn't long before I realized that particularly my older child, my daughter needed some therapy. She admitted that she'd been crying a lot, but only on the inside. And so it was then I knew, okay, she needs to go to therapy. And at that age, therapy is really more just creating a safe space for the kid to just play and express their feelings. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was, it changed everything. It was so devastating, because I remember shortly after the accident, going to this gymnastics show that my kids were in. And I remember looking around at all the dads that in those days people had camcorders, you know, and they were recording their kids' little somersaults or cartwheels or whatever. I remember looking around, and even though I was sitting there with my sister and brother-in-law who were there and very caring, and I had a really strong support system, it suddenly hit me. I am really now a single parent. Like there's going to be no one in these kids' lives aside from me who's going to be as invested in their lives. So yeah, it was a profound, affected us all profoundly.
Wow. Yeah. So, at some point in time, and this is, I don't know how long it was, but at some point in time, you made a major decision. All right. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah. And that's really what the book is about, because I couldn't find that story. As an avid reader, I'd found stories of people that had had these tragedies happen to them and had risen to the challenge and dealt with it by changing their desires and doing what they needed to do. I knew when my own health started to fail, and my sense of self and my sense of confidence that I could raise these kids and I could keep our household together and I could do this. The confidence just, there was none. I felt terrified about the prospect of him coming home. We had a smallish house. I just felt like he needed 24/7 supervision. He was very impulsive and very incontinent at the time. He had seizures. Saying he was like a child is, it's not terribly accurate, but it's as close as I can get. He just, you know how children just don't have these, they don't have impulse control. They don't have filters. That describes David, even to this day. When my health started to fail and I ended up being hospitalized as well, I had a meeting with a social worker because we were making arrangements for him to come home. His coming home had been postponed because of my illness. And I came home weighing like 100 pounds because an eating disorder I'd had kicked in as well. And she basically gave me the permission to consider other options. She said, why don't we have him go into a brain injury rehab facility for a little while? And I said, no, I can't do that. He's my husband. It's my job to take care of him. I'm a nice Jewish girl. This is what we do. I mean, I know that sounds a little, I don't know, kitschy or something, but it's true. That's how I felt. I felt that it was my duty. I couldn't imagine any other option. And yet she opened that door. She gave me permission to consider that other avenue. And I told myself it's just temporary. And it just bought me a little time to recover myself and perhaps for him to get even that much more improved in his physical and cognitive health. But then as time went on, he kept having physical issues primarily. At one point he did what they call elope. He tried to leave. He just started walking out of the facility and down the road. And it felt horrible. It felt like I was a jailer of some kind. His family was very angry with me. I was accused of being his jailer, of being a warden and keeping him in a place with other crazy people, you know, instead of bringing him home where he would be better off. But I knew in my heart, in my soul, in my everything, that I would implode and our whole family therefore would implode if he came home. And so I made that decision to not have him come home. And so I kind of gave away the book's ending, but there is more to it, of course, because it's my journey on that decision, toward that decision, that I think is important, that there are so many people these days. I think you and probably everyone who's listening to this, either themselves or know someone who has been put in a position of being a caregiver to a degree where it was very hard on them. And I dedicated my book to caregivers because I really believe they're heroes, even the ones that are being paid for it, because maybe it's such a heroic act. It's so selfless. And it wasn't, all I could give was to my kids. All I had was to take care of myself and my kids. I didn't have the bandwidth, if you will, to be that caregiver that David needed. So,
although you decided at the end of the day not to be his caregiver, all right, you didn't totally give up on him. You did help him in other ways. Tell us about that.
Yes, absolutely. Lest I sound like some kind of villain, I asked myself this question, what can I do? And I know that's a sort of a basic question that therapists might ask their patients, you know, well, rather than beating yourself up for what you can't do, why don't you really focus on what you can do. Mm-hmm. So what I decided I could do, because he was in a facility in a town about a half an hour away from us, which is really, was really doable. And every time I could, I had the facility, they had a service where they would bring him up to visit us, either our house where we had dinner, usually on Sundays, just because that was the easiest day for everyone, people were home, or if the kids were in a performance or had a baseball game or a karate, you know, tournament or something, whatever it was, some event at school, bar mitzvah, bar bat mitzvah. David was there for those. Actually, by then he'd already moved to Israel. I'll get to the end of the story in a second, but he currently lives, he's still alive and he lives in Israel with his sister near Tel Aviv. So in answer to your question, that was one of the things I could do. And the other thing was to go visit him and to take the family on outings. We would go to Best Buy, buy a charging cable. You know, that was a big event, right? Mm-hmm. We would go to a restaurant, but going to a restaurant was actually really stressful because he didn't walk well. His back injuries never really healed very well. He would be inappropriate, never to the point where it was, he wasn't violent, but there was so much unpredictability, again, that it was stressful. And then, of course, I was dealing with my small children, too, at the same time. One time I remember my daughter was at somewhere else, and I took my son and I took them to a nearby state park, and we went on this hike. And I remember driving up there and realizing I have no cell signal. If my 7-year-old, you know, breaks his ankle, or, you know, what am I going to do? Like, or what if David falls, or, you know, and so I realized, what am I thinking? I can't do this hike, right? It changes so much about the way that how you view like what a family life should be, or what you expect it of it. I know I meandered a little bit, but
no, that's fine. But basically, I mean, what I'm getting out of this is that although, you know, caregiving was out of the question, all right, kind of keeping the family together and making sure that he knows who his kids are, and making sure that the kids know who he is, that was something that you've done. And that is also, I mean, that's a major accomplishment, you know, and trying to keep the family together. That's also important. Look, not everybody can do everything. You know, it reminds me of one of the Clint Eastwood movies with Dirty Harry, where he goes, man's got to know his limitations, you know? So, you know, you, and look, I understand that you realized that you had limitations and you knew that you couldn't, you know, do the things that you, although you may have wanted to do them. Okay. You know, it was just beyond your scope, which is fine. Okay. Because like I said, you were helping in other ways, keeping the family together, making sure the kids, making sure he's there for the bar mitzvahs, for the parties, for all these things. And that is also very, very important. Now, let me ask you this. Okay. What prompted you to write your book? First of all, tell us a little bit. What was the name of the book?
The book Crash. Is called Crash, which of course implies is his crash, but mainly my crash, right?
Oh, interesting.
And then the subtitle is How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. And it does seem a little bit ironic because I've been speaking for the last several minutes about how I didn't become his caregiver. However, I was, as you say, a caregiver of a sort. It just mm-hmm. wasn't the one who was there helping him to the bathroom every single day and making sure he got his meds and, you know, all of the above. It wasn't that. Mm-hmm. It was a different format. And I remember having a conversation with the director of the brain injury facility where he was, and it was a town called Gilroy. And she asked if I wanted to go to this brain injury seminar. It was a one-day seminar, and for caregivers. And I said, well, I'm not his caregiver. And she looked at me and she said, oh my God, yes, you are. You know, even though, as I say, you're not doing it in the conventional sense. Mm-hmm. So that's why my publisher and I went back and forth about the title. At first it was like a memoir of motherhood, guilt, and I can't remember the third one. But it really, I think guilt is a very important theme in my book about what I expect of myself, what society expected of me, and what I did or didn't do. Shame enters in there too. But what prompted me, I think, and I didn't start writing it until about 3.5 years after the accident. Mm-hmm. I have no real training as a writer. You know, I as you said, I'm a singer. I teach voice. I've been a performer, an actor all my life. I was a cantor, a cantorial soloist, meaning my degree is in music, not in cantorial studies. And so I had to figure out how to do it. But I knew that there was a story. I felt like, like I said earlier, because I had found other stories about people with tragic things happening to them, and telling the story of their journey to either they personally wrote it, their journey to overcome it, or their caregiver's journey, how the caregiver rose to be the caregiver, those demands. My story was so different. It was, in a way, the anti-hero. And I felt that it was important to give people like me a voice, that you can have self-respect by making a different decision, choosing a different path than is expected of you. Or in hindsight, you should have done something differently. I felt it was important that story be told. And what I was very much afraid of was that it would come across as whiny or complaining, that, you know, kvetching, that oh, poor me. And everyone who read it in advance, the drafts, different drafts, was very clear that it didn't read that way. I just wanted to tell my story. This is what happened. This is the decision I made. This is how I felt about it. This is how I got through it. So that's why I wrote it. But again, I had to learn how. I started by just taking classes and just starting. I started in the middle. I started with the scene of that social worker telling me I didn't have to take him home that one day.
Well, so it took you 3.5 years. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. My book that I wrote took me 9 years to decide to write it. All right. I didn't write that. That my book came out on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. So
how long did it take you to write?
It took me about 9 months to write it.
Mine took 11 years.
Okay.
So you win in the first category. I win in the second.
There you go. Let me ask you something. Who is the one person you can point to that you would say had the most influence on your life? And why? And I'm not talking about your husband, obviously, because, that was just like something that obviously he didn't do that on purpose. Okay. But, you know, there must have been somebody in your life that you point to and say, you know, without that person, I never would have made it. Or, you know, but that's the person who gave me the strength. Or, who would that person be?
Yeah, so usually when people ask me that question, I talk about my high school choir teacher.
Okay.
Just because of his encouragement for me to sing. But your question had two parts, and in retrospect, looking back now, And having just spoken about my book for the past and my story for the past however many minutes, I believe that it really was my therapist. And I started seeing her actually when I was 19. My mother was an alcoholic, and I was blaming myself. And so I started therapy when I was 19, and wow. I saw the same person. Yeah, but I saw her on and off over the years. She just happened to live in the same area where I live in. And and I think it's having that safe space to go whenever I needed to and get that mirror back, get those questions asked that forced me to look back inside and just tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And really tell the truth without filters, you know, without worrying about how it's going to come across. I had that such a safe space to do that. And once I did that, you know, you can't really turn back. I couldn't. So I do believe that my therapist got me through it, and through all other things in my life, the eating disorder, as I said, my parents' divorce, my mother's alcoholism. You know, we all have burdens, as you said at the beginning, those bricks that you know, sometimes they're little and they just crumble when they hit you, and sometimes they're massive, like like your experience. And this experience with the plane crash, the brick was ginormous. It was gigantic.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And it altered you and, you know, me completely forever. And most of us, well, some of us can weather it if we have the right support system and know where to turn to get that. So I would say my therapist.
Wow. Okay, so let me ask you this before we go. Any words of wisdom that you can share with my audience, something they can take away, something that can help them?
You know, I didn't really know what Whispers and Bricks was. And when you explained it in the beginning of this, I feel like, you know, when the bricks are coming at you, listen, the whispers are still there, even if they're very soft, listen to them. And that whisper was telling me, it's okay to give myself permission to consider an option that isn't popular, that isn't what's expected. Give yourself permission at least to open yourself up to other options. If you feel trapped, if you feel that there's no way out of a situation that you're being forced into, then there are little glimmers that you can follow that may be more true to who you are and what you want to do.
Wow. That sounds like great, great advice. Now, if people want to get in touch with you, what would be the best way for them to do that? Do you have like a website, or do you have an email or social media?
I have a website. It's my name, rachelmichaelbergauthor.com. I don't know if you're going to put it, you want me to spell it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Rachel is R-A-C-H-E-L, M like Mary, I-C-H. E-L, B like boy, E-R-G, author.com.
Rachel Michelberg, author.com.
It's also rachelmauthor@gmail.com.
@gmail.com, yep.
And my book is available. It's distributed traditionally, so it's available through any bookstore, and I believe it might be on sale right now, the Kindle version for 99 cents.
Oh, wow. Is there,
at the 1 year anniversary, my publisher does a 99 cent sale.
Oh, wow.
It might've gone up starting today. Sorry.
There you go. All right.
Worth it, I think.
I hear you. Rachel, thanks so much for sharing your story with my audience. I know that there are people out there that are in the same boat that you were in, wondering, you know, can they make that decision as well? I think you coming out is very, very brave. It's very strong. that you come out and say, look, I know my limitations, okay? And I don't need to feel guilty about the fact that I have limitations, because I do what I do. I can do, I do what I can do, and what I can't do, I don't do. And, you know, there's something to be said for that. I mean, again, not everybody's Superman, and not everybody's Batman, okay? It takes, you know, different kinds of people in this world.
In fact, most of us aren't.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. But anyway, listen, good luck going forward. So you're now you've remarried, correct?
Yes, I remarried. I married a physicist. He's working on dark matter discovery.
Wow.
Goes right over my head. Yeah, yes. My kids are 24 and 23, doing really well. Both graduated college. And yeah, I'm still singing, doing a little writing, not as much.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, thanks so much. Good luck going forward. I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your story. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks, and I'm your host, Ari Shomer. Remember, if you feel like you're stuck in the mud, like you're spinning your wheels, wasting time in your career, your business, your life, if you know you're not enjoying all the success, satisfaction, significance that you desire, then it's time for you to book a call with me at callwithari.com. Check out my Whispers and Bricks Coaching Academy. Until next time, listen to the whispers, avoid the bricks, and never, ever
give listener up every your single week that posts a review on iTunes now will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.